Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Ones Ready podcast. I am your host, Trent. I have Espo. Can I call you Espo?
You call me Espo.
Yeah.
You're out now.
We've known each other for a while. It's a hard habit to break, you know, sir. Excuse me. You know, we go back a ways, but like, I don't want to ruin the introduction. I appreciate you being on the podcast. How you doing?
Doing well. You know, starting off, you know, my apologies for ducking you guys. I think now for the last 3 years, these guys have been asking me, When are you coming on? Because there's a lot of good stuff that's been going on. And I've, you know, finally come to terms with, you know, talking about myself a little bit and sharing, you know, my experiences. But no, thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, of course. You know, and it's hard to come on here and talk about yourself. It's awkward. I get that. And B, though, even though you didn't come on for a long time, I do want to thank you for being one of the I don't want to say few people, but one of the group of people that never, you know, came at us in a negative way. Like, you saw the potential, or you saw what we were trying to do. So even though it wasn't really great in the beginning, always appreciated your support.
Yeah, you know, first guy through the door always gets bloody.
Yeah.
So you guys have definitely gotten bloody, and doesn't matter. You guys have absolutely set the standard for, you know, messaging and everything for our communities. Yeah.
Well, and we can only go up from here.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to talk about your career in a nutshell. So let's start in the beginning.
Can I start off with one acknowledgement?
Oh, yeah. No.
All right. We're 30 days out from Atlantic City UFC fight. Connor Matthews, it's a UFC debut. Talk a little bit more about Connor in this podcast, so stick around. But yeah, absolutely worthy to check him out if you don't know who he is already. And yeah, follow him. He's going to go far, and I have no doubts. He definitely will never quit. And from personal experience, he cannot be killed. So
it's impossible. Yeah, check it out. The Ones Ready logo will actually be on his fight flag. That's harder than I thought it would be to say, fight flag. So yeah, full support for Connor. And yeah, March 30th, check it out. Make sure you're watching that fight, because it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So you are also a combat controller.
Yeah. So came in the military 2004 to be a combat controller. You know, I was drawn to the military for a lot of the same reasons folks were back then. Not that it's changed very much now, but you know, I had a motivation to come in the military and do a thing. Big difference is the lack of information that we had back then. I had a recruiter who told me that he doesn't really know exactly what we do. And he doesn't, you know, have all the different answers, but he handed me a trifold, and had like, an operator standing at the bottom of a, you know, a platform. And he just had his arms crossed looking up at the camera, and around him was just all this gear, silenced weapons, radios, four wheelers, dirt bikes, scuba tanks, parachutes. Man, you think about like the cool, you know, James Bond, Gucci gear, like that, that's all the stuff that was just around the guy. And I'm like, man, that's all the stuff that they use. And he's like, yeah. And they're crazy. I was like, okay.
Well, as an 18-year-old, you're not like, how do I carry all that? Oh, you're, yeah, like, no, that looks cool, man.
Yeah, no. No, that doesn't matter. That's going in the bag. But yeah, so I initially did not go in the Air Force office. I went in the Marine office, you know, some of the biggest, strongest culture, the Army office, the Navy, talked to all the recruiters, and, you know, they're just like, yeah, obviously the SEALs, the Green Berets, the Rangers. And that's what I wanted to do. I had some great advice from some folks to tell me to go check out the Air Force, which I finally agreed. And then with a little bit more information, I found that, you know, what I thought at the time was that combat control was the thing or the position that you could be in to do the most damage in a shortest amount of time possible. And so that's what I chose. I wanted to, you know, go after the enemy. I want to get it on. You know, I definitely wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. I want to be a part of a team, all the things. But I wanted to go after the bad guys. That was the thing that I was most motivated to do.
Yeah. So step one, you went to the Y, you learned how to swim from the old folks, and then right into the pipeline, ready to go.
Yeah. No development, no information. every day prior to coming to the military, you know, getting in the water. Yeah, absolutely. Talking to the old people and be like, how are you swimming for an hour straight? And then finally developing my own like little training routine, that I think was a pretty successful, because back in the day you got one chance to do any kind of physical training outside of the regular basic military training. And that was when they threw everybody in the pool at the same time and said, you got to do this. And if you don't make it, you're going to do another job in the military. 3, 2, 1, go. Everyone's a one, you know, one's ready to go. And so for the first couple laps, like if you've ever done triathlon, it's an absolute fight. You're getting kicked, you're getting punched, you're bumping into people. It's chaos. You know, you're going to get 20% of the people in that first, you know, 2-3 minutes, they're going to get out of the water and say, this just isn't for me. Yep. After that, it spreads out a little bit. Everyone kind of finds their lanes and their places and you just continue to go, and you get in the zone. But you know, made it through that. Basic training was, you know, like a lot of people then and now, it wasn't what I thought. It wasn't what, you know, they portray in the movies. It was like marching. It was folding clothes and making beds perfectly. Real good close friend of mine who's a drill instructor who would argue till he's blue in the face, and talk about how marching is a, you know, where discipline stems from. I don't think I'm there yet, but you know, the guy's really good at what he does. He was a BMT instructor. He later went on to be a drill instructor at the officer candidate school. He's absolutely just an inspirational individual. He's retired now, but yeah, he talked about how discipline stems from those little things, those things that are like kind of nuanced. And so, you know, also the same things that we do in the pipeline, like how your name has to be perfect on your water bottle, you know, how you stencil your shirt, all that stuff's got to be perfect, because it all relates back to that attention to detail step, where that's going to relate to the attention to detail you're going to have when you're setting up your underwater breathing apparatus or your parachute and the things that really are life sustaining. And by the way, it's just how you get to the job. And then there's going to be a whole lot more attention to detail. From the things you say to the things you do, you make one wrong move, it could be your life or your buddies. So, I got BMT out of the way, and I got to the pipeline and I discovered, you know, the instructors. I discovered, you know, in combat control selection course at the time, you know, the different things that you can do and you can't do. And, I got dropped a million times and there were some pretty psychotic, hilarious instructors at the time who definitely knew how to dial it up and push us.
That doesn't sound like them at all.
No. It you know, push it to the limits. And man, dude, it was just great because like you'd embrace it. And there was like a sense of competition. It's something that I think nowadays, like if you're coming in to do this or if you're going to do anything that's challenging, if you look at it as a competition, it's going to be 1,000 times better. You're competing to be the best at that thing. You're not competing to survive. If you're competing to survive, then maybe this isn't for you. But, you know, you see that in the pipeline when you're a student. You see it, you know, when you're an instructor later on. But,
yeah, there's a time for collaboration, but that comes later, right? And I think that's what our society is focused on a lot these days. But, yeah, in the beginning of that, we need to know that you're the caliber of person that we will collaborate with, right? So you need to get in there, compete, embrace it, attack it and get through it, you know, just like you got through your pipeline.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, just like everybody else, like I had my setbacks. I definitely had things I had to learn. You know, being, you know, 20 pounds lighter than I am now, you know, carrying rucks and finning were like the two challenges for me, like the Smurf squad, if you will. Yeah. So like that kind of stuff's difficult, but everything else, like, you know, the pool thankfully was my happy place. If you could be good at one thing, I would suggest, you know, being good in the water. But you know, working in the water, working calisthenics, all that stuff's, it's all real important. It's important equally. And in preparation of that, you know, building muscle is going to build capability, but you got to build your cardiovascular and muscular endurance at the same time.
Yep.
Otherwise you're just building, you know, oxygen, depriving, you know, tissue. It's going to suck a lot of oxygen up and you're going to black out underwater. We'll pull you out. But yeah.
Yeah. Always fun when you see the show muscles show up, you know, yeah. there's always the guys that do it right and show up and you're like, I don't know, man, you're pretty big, but you know, and I think later on we're going to invite you back. We'll probably do like a whole pipeline episode because AETC and you and I probably could go for hours. But you made it through and then you got your first assignment. And obviously we've talked a little bit before and your first assignment was unusual, coming straight out of the pipeline.
Yeah. So out of the pipeline, I wanted to get as far away from Ohio as possible. Love Ohio, but I wanted to explore the world. And so I chose, I want to go to Okinawa, Japan. It's a tiny little island in the Pacific. That's all I knew at the time. And so that's, I got my first choice. I was the only one from my team to kind of go out there. So I was kind of going alone. You know, as soon as you get there, the first things that happens is they kind of embrace you. They take you in, they'll take you out and stuff like that. But I think there was three people on the team that was actually there at the time. Yeah. And that's essentially how it went for the entire time I was there, because you have to grow up really quickly in that environment on such a small team that has such a big commitment in a place that's kind of like dislocated from everything else in the States. It's harder to train. It's, you know, you're traveling quite a bit to get to all the different places you're going to work. And so you got to grow up pretty quickly. You have to be very mature. You have to be always on parade in that environment. You have to look professional. Sometimes you're in uniform, but sometimes you're also in a suit and tie, going in into an embassy, and discussing like how you're going to operate, in those countries with those, you know, partner forces. And, you know, if you deteriorate trust at that point, you show up and you got long hair, you haven't shaved, that might limit your ability to just go and work in those places. Cause, trust equals free maneuver, just like in everything else we do. So you have to be professional very quickly. Going in that environment. I think that was really good for me as a young operator.
Oh, yeah. And first impressions, lasting impressions, all that other kind of stuff. And I think one of the things that a lot of people might not know is the overseas STSs are a little bit different than the stateside ones, especially back then. All of us stateside guys were just Afghanistan, Iraq. But you all have like a region that you also have to do, plus the other stuff as well.
Yeah. You know, you get to visit a lot of countries, everything from Korea to Australia. And everything in between, you know, is very, very rewarding to go work with those countries. It's very important to go work with those countries. You take, for instance, the Thai cave rescue. That's not the first time we worked with Thai special operations. You know, I'd work with them typically twice a year, and we got to know them very well. We built those relationships so that when things happened, or, you know, when shit hits the fan, like that's not when you're getting to introduce yourself to, you know, the partner force that you're going to go and go do dangerous stuff with.
You can actually get out of the embassy to go.
Yeah. So very, very rewarding doing that. You know, you learn a lot of different languages very quickly, and then pretty soon you just start talking randomly in multiple languages and no one understands what you're saying. So
right.
I'm sure that'll come out later in life. So anyways, yeah, working with those partner forces was amazing. But at the time, I stormed into my op soup's office as a young staff sergeant operator, JTAC. And I was just like, I'm tired of going and working in, these other countries and seeing these amazing hotels. And, I was like, I want to get my fight on. I want to get it on. You know, my buddies are going to Afghanistan, Iraq. Like, that's what I want to do.
You're like the anti-diva. You're like, I'm tired of these 5-star resorts and all this other crap.
Yeah.
Send me to Afghanistan.
Yeah. Cause like at the time, I mean, you could definitely attest to this. You want to be with your buddies who are stateside, who are going to the fight. They're going to the thing. That's the main event. All the stuff that is going on in Asia is very, very important. You know, if you compare it to now, you know, there's places where we're operating, that, you know, 3 or 4 places that everybody in the world knows about. There's also 3 or 4 places that nobody knows about. And, that's how it is. It's always like that. There's never a slow time. So, at the time, I wanted to get to, you know, get in the fight, just like a lot of the individuals that are trying to come in now. And so he said, he's like, you gotta go to the tier one unit. You gotta go to North Carolina. That's what you gotta do. And I said, dog, sign me up. I'll go right now. And he's like, no, he's like, wait, he's like, you gotta get to the 2-1 STS at Bragg. He's like, do a train up, deploy with them. And then assess. He's like, you'll get a much better understanding, much better concept of things. And so you'll have a better chance at assessment, you know, further down the line. And I was like, all right, let's go.
Well, because everybody says the final part of the pipeline is that first deployment, right? Especially like our generation, like, because you learn so much on that first deployment. So I think that was very wise of him. B, just it highlights something about our community that is like a like E4. You can just barge into like your op soup office or the superintendent's office and just be like, hey,
yeah,
I want to give you this. And he's, you know, not kicking you out of his office. He's like, okay, like, let's make a plan instead of just like, you know, I'm a master or senior or whatever. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And, you know, I wouldn't have cared either at the time. Yeah. Getting yelled at wasn't a big thing. But yeah, it was absolutely a high trust, high confidence environment. And as long as you maintain that high trust, that high confidence with your leadership, you could have this conversation. That's how it is now. You know, definitely from a perspective now as a leader, I have that, I seek that. You want that as a leader. And if you're doing a good job, I think that's what you'll get. But, yeah, I made a big stink of it. I said, okay, like, let's go. A couple months later, he did everything he could. He got me to North Carolina. I was already a JTAC. So I started a train up and then, I deployed. It was awesome because, man, it's not the same, comparison. I use the rock star analogy. So like you're a rock and roll artist or you're a musician, you're very good. And then this is when you deploy, it's like you're on tour.
Yep.
And so I get to Afghanistan. I get paired with an ODA, amazing group of, individuals. And we were kind of like at a FOB in the middle of nowhere. And it was on. I paired myself up with, another guy that was on that team who was going to go on an assess at his higher levels after that deployment. And so we were in the gym 2-3 times a day, crush as many chicken breasts as possible, picking up heavy stuff around the FOB and just carrying it as long as we possibly could. And everybody else thought we were insane.
Were you guys getting ring route food or were they dropping it in?
We were getting dropped in.
Okay.
It wasn't the greatest.
Yeah.
But honestly, we weren't there for the food.
So, had to ask.
Yeah, no, it's important. It's food.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, during that deployment, it was pretty bad. We found a lot of IEDs. On one operation, we were maneuvering in some of the mountainous areas, and we had found an IED, came upon an IED, and we had made the decision that we were going to collect some of the forensics from it. And so the weapons expert, my buddy, was kind of like moving in the vicinity of it and placing a displacement charge so that we could blow it without destroying it completely, but essentially rendering it like useless. And as he was doing that, the IED actually went off, and I was pretty close to it, so close that like dirt hit my face, and I just was kind of surprised. I was like, fire in the hole would have been, you know, kind of nice.
Right.
And I turned around and I saw him lying on the ground, and he was kind of like having a seizure. And so right then and there, like, I knew it was on. Immediately got into a tick. I got aircraft overhead, and I had comms with artillery. And I used, I think it was 2 F-16s. Yeah, 2 Navy F-16s. And they're
18s?
F-18s. I'm sorry, not no. F-16s. Yeah, they're 2.
Because someone would be like, oh, Navy?
Yeah, no. Sorry. Should know my airplanes and Air Force.
It's all good.
But yeah, 2 F-18s checked on with some pretty good eyes. And I used them in the artillery to work within the POIs and eliminate the enemy that had set it off. But, you know, while that's going on, I got the medevac helicopter coming in, and they got my buddy out of there pretty quick. So first time we took like a hit or a casualty from an IED. He ended up living, by the way. But we were pretty charged up emotionally. We had some other operations coming. About a week later, on another combat reconnaissance patrol, found ourselves in our tick. I'm in the back of the Humvee, kind of at the time is light skin Humvee. Like there's no armor on it. I'm essentially in the back of a pickup truck.
Because before all the big ones that are like IED resistant and all that other stuff, the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days.
Yeah.
So I'm essentially in the back of a pickup truck that's, you know, that's got a 240 Bravo machine gun that I'm working. Then we have the turret gunner and the driver and the team leader. And, I'm on the radio. The last thing I remember was I'm on the radio. I was talking to some of the people on the team and some of the aircraft. And then, it was a lights out, lights out for me. But what had happened was we rolled over an IED. It went off right under the rear part of the vehicle, right underneath where I was sitting, which in turn catapulted me through the air. And I kind of just like ragdolled and fell some distance in front of the Humvee. I think my face hit the 240, like kind of like the weapon that I was using, yeah, because it knocked out some of my teeth. Both my legs were kind of like, you know, all the bones were essentially shattered and blown apart. I had a broken back, you know, several small burns, and yeah, pretty significant TBI. Thankfully, my the head Delta was in the truck behind me, and very quickly he got to me and said I was kind of like still smoking, had no respirations, no pulse. He reestablished that, made sure my airway was clear, and then I was on a medevac and got out of there. They eventually got me to a hotel, or I'm sorry, hotel. They eventually got me to a hospital in Afghanistan. Hotel
for broken people, yeah, or whatever. Yeah.
Got to a hospital in Afghanistan, and then they did some surgery. Got me on a medevac bird to Landstuhl, Germany, and did some more surgery in Landstuhl, which is when I woke up. It's my first memories. It was kind of like a dream. I didn't know if I was dreaming or if I was dead, because it's just like it is in the movies at that point. You're in a white, like a white, you know, hospital room with curtains surrounding it, and you're like, I'm either dead or I got really hurt, because I'm not in Afghanistan anymore.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like my first memories, and from what I'm told, and from what I remember, I was just thinking about how much of a pain in the ass it was going to be to get back to my team. And I was like, the flights, and then I was gonna have to get a helicopter, and then like it just didn't. It's just impossible to realize exactly like how bad it was, and that my life was gonna be changed forever. So, you know, while I'm in Germany, they tried to order me to call my parents, which was the last thing I wanted to do. You know, God bless my parents. But like, you know, you're a kid and you wreck your bike, and your friend's parents are like, you call your mom. You're like, I'm not calling my mom. She said this was going to happen.
You know how mad they'll be.
Yeah.
You know, man.
Yeah. But I eventually did that. And then, you know, I got on a, medevac flight.
No, I want, okay. I don't mean to stop you, but the conversation, the first conversation you had with your parents,
Sorry.
I know we're trying to get to something else, but like, to me, it was hilarious. Cause it kind of just sums up, you know, so many people that I've known in that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's fair. I called, and, they didn't answer. They were out eating or something, and they still have the message, and they love the, let other people listen to it. That's one of their favorite things. But I called and I was like, hey, and you can tell my voice is kind of weird. Like my chest has essentially been destroyed and like everything else is going on. I was like, hey, I'm in Germany now. Like I'm okay. I'm fine. But they want me to come back, and I'm going to be in DC at a hospital. And they said to like, I had to call you, but everything's okay. Like, anyways, I'll talk to you guys later. Click. And apparently, I don't remember the phone call I had to give them like later when they finally called back. But I talked to them, and they're like, okay, you know, we'll go to DC. Like, yeah, we'll meet you there. Like, do you need anything? You want us to bring your car? And and then I had to give the phone to the doctor, and he's like, he didn't explain this well at all. And then what he told them was very severe.
A 40-minute explanation.
Yeah, like, hey, he just sustained life-threatening injuries, and he's going to be different for the rest of his life. And they're like, I don't know what to believe. So, yeah, big apologies. Like, if you hurt yourself, make sure your mom knows. Tell them the truth. It doesn't help them to not. But anyway, I finally get to D.C. The flight to D.C., I remember 100%. Shout out to everybody. It's a caregiver or a medevac person of any kind. I think every single person on the airplane, except for the pilots, tried to help me, tried to make me comfortable, but it was absolute miserable. And I just distinctly remember every single doc and nurse on that flight trying to like move my legs or give me something to like make it more comfortable. And
because it's not really an ICU, right? Like, so like they probably couldn't put you like all the way under, or you know, like they don't have like the same equipment. So it's like, we need to keep you kind of conscious.
Yeah.
So man, that's
they're rough. Yeah, they're very good at what they do. I mean, the experience that they had, unfortunately, like they're the experts at, you know, taking care of people. And yeah, just big shout out to them. They're unbelievable. Got to DC, Walter Reed at the time. And I ended up having, I think it was like close to 40 days in the intensive care unit. You know, you're getting shots. Like the worst part about the ICU was you're continually being bothered. Yeah. And a lot of times, like Wounded Warriors, anyone that came back from theater around that time, they can all attest, like it's really old. I'm so old that like I hung a sign on my hospital door that says, if you are not this person or this person, like do not come in my room.
Right.
And like, you would probably get like a water bottle thrown at you if you did. Especially like the social workers and the people that are trying to like get information and do their jobs. Again, I was very, very angry. Because like at the time, like you go from the very top of like your life, like the thing you wished and tried and worked so hard to accomplish.
Yeah.
And it's just ripped from your grip. Like there's, you have no choice in the matter. And, that man, dude, that's a hard pill to swallow.
It's like extreme alpha to like people treating you like you're a victim of something. Right. And you lose your identity and your team and your boys and all that other stuff. It's gotta be, I can't even imagine.
Yeah. It's absolutely very, very hard to come to grips with, no matter how stubborn you are, no matter how, you know, gung-ho devoted you are. Like when chaos like that injects itself into your life, like you can't plan for that. Yeah. You know, we all plan to, you know, go and do the things that we're going to do and, you know, we could die, right? That's something you absolutely are at terms with. You're like, okay, like I might die, but this is a worthy and noble cause. Like no big deal. But nobody thinks about or nobody plans to survive and to, you know, possibly be disabled or hurt very, very bad. You probably shouldn't do that anyways. You'd be pretty sick if like you're like, all right, well, if this happens and I'm going to do this and I'll kind of put this stuff over here. And yeah, like you're not going to plan that. So it's something that happened to me. It was a very, very big surprise to me. I knew the rest I was taking at the time. And you know, I'd do it again. But I think that, you know, when you get to Walter Reed, or when I got to Walter Reed, I think the worst thing was like going through my last surgery, like waking up from that, wasn't too bad because like I was still very drugged up. But it was a couple hours after that, it was like one of the worst pains I think ever. But I had amazing family and friends come and see me. I had I met some pretty crazy stars like Tiger Woods and like there's just all kinds of celebrities that would come to the hospital and see you. And then I had a, you know, every week, a van of people from the 2-1 would drive up and come see me. And that was pretty amazing. We had some pretty awesome combat mission support folks at the time, who I was friends with, and they would come up and just hang out with me or take me out to eat or something, or give me a coffee. Yeah. That wasn't a coffee from the, you know, the hospital. Yeah. And it was just really nice. That was a really big deal. One of my, last points on Walter Reed was, I was there for about 6 months, kind of in the wheelchair for that 6 months. And like the week I got up and could stand up for the first time, they were like, we're sending you to Texas. And I was like, all right. And that was the Center for the Intrepid. But, right around the end of my time at Walter Reed, I remember like I developed this habit of like, I'd get out of my room and like, I'd wheel outside so I can get some sun for like, you know, 30, 40 minutes. And I have like an iced tea from the vending machine. And I would just sit there and just zone out and have my tea. Sometimes listen to music. And, there's, I think he was like a Vietnam veteran or something. He was sitting in the bench kind of like right next to me and he kind of like scooted over and he was just, you know, like, hey, how's it going? I was like, oh, it's not bad. And, you know, it's no big deal. Like I'm getting out of here, going to Texas. And he's like, so what happened? And I'm just like, all right. And I told him my story. I was like, it's not that big of a deal. I'm like, I'm going to recover. Like it's fine. And like, I had this whole plan and he looks at me and he's just like, hey man, he's like, I just need you to know. He's like, this is going to haunt you for the rest of your life. He's like, the sooner you could come to terms with that, the sooner it's going to be easier to deal with. And I was like, okay, that's
sure,
cool,
man. Yeah.
It's like, thanks man. That's awesome. I'm just drinking my tea. And I'm like, man, dude, like, and I'm starting to think about it. And I'm like, you know, thinking about my injuries and like, you know, I could easily just be like, yeah, the doctors are like telling me I'm never going to do this. I'm never going to do that. Like, definitely never getting back to the job. And I'm like, man, dude, this guy, like, this guy's got a point, but like, I'm not going to let anything haunt me that, you know, I don't want to haunt me. Like, yeah. It's completely my decision. And so whether it be, you know, intentional or whatever, like, I definitely needed to hear that at the time because I was like, no, like, I'm not letting anything haunt me that I don't want to haunt me. So, that helped. That definitely helped drive me even further on and push past like all kinds of physical pains and things like that. Fast forward a little bit, got down to Texas, the Center for the Intrepid, another amazing center of excellence where just there's a unbelievable community of wounded warriors and caregivers that really will take it to the limits or push you very, very hard in therapy. And that's probably one of the reasons why I was able to recover the way I was, especially at the time, because I got down to Texas and I couldn't remember how to walk. I definitely couldn't remember how to go downstairs. That was pretty scary. And so, you know, very slowly, you'd kind of like hit plateaus, but you'd continually increase your recovery over the time that you were there. And I think it was like 6 or 7 months into it, we developed this little community of wounded warriors that would do like these CrossFit workouts or these Metcons that were like high intensity, but they involved people with like all kinds of disabilities. But no matter what, we would figure out a way to overcome those disabilities. Like if you didn't have hands, the people at the CFI would figure out how to hook the rower up to these things that you'd put on your arms so you could do the row portion of the workout. I'll never forget another one of my close buddies didn't have any legs. Like, so wall pushups were kind of hard, or the handstand pushups were kind of hard. So he'd put his prosthetics up on the wall and we'd hold him up there for him. And he'd do the wall pushups. And it was
sounds
just
like it should be easier because it doesn't have legs.
Well, yeah, it was just absolutely unbelievable demonstration of the human will. Right. And, just basically the, I don't care what hand I've been given. Like I'm not going to let this haunt me. I'm not going to let this bother me.
Well, you're not going to use it as an excuse to not keep competing.
Yeah. So, I mean, that went on for 13 months, as at the CFI. While I was there, you know, in the back of my head, like I was still like leaning very far forward. Like I'm getting back, I'm going back to my team. But in the back of my head, I'm like, this might not work. I better have like a plan B. So I started going to college. Yeah. And it was, I was just like, yeah, I got to go to college because I better get good at something else. This is the only plan I had. Like right. This from the start was the only plan I had. So I started going to school and I realized that like, this is kind of cool. This is awesome. In high school, plucking me out of, you know, math or science or any of the different classes. And you were like, hey, Espo, why do you think you need to know triangulation? I've been like, I don't know. I'm never going to ever use this. This is the dumbest thing ever. I had zero perspective. Yeah, that's just who I was in high school. Did not care about school. I cared enough about school to get through school. And then I just cared about playing hockey or racing four-wheelers. Those are the things that I cared about.
Well, I think one of the things that a lot of us have in common is we're experiential learners. And until you can find a reason through experience and falling down a whole bunch of times, then until you have a reason, then we're not very interested in stuff.
Yeah. And so going to college was actually a lot of fun. I started learning things that I could actually apply. I could see why they're important. And I was doing really, really well in school. And I did that all the way till the end of school. But back to CFI. While I was there, I think it was towards the end of my time, there was a nonprofit organization called, I'll think of it in a second.
Yeah.
But there's a nonprofit organization that approached me and they're like, hey, we're going to take a couple wounded warriors and veterans across the country on bicycles to prove the capabilities that people still have after they've been injured severely.
So they're not putting you in a basket. You're actually
no. Yeah. You're pedaling. You're doing all this stuff. No motors. And I was like, yeah, I'll do that. Sign me up. You know, thankfully I called down to my unit. I was like, hey, can I do this? And they're like, absolutely. If it's part of your therapy. So I honestly didn't believe it until like the day we started. And I was like, I can't believe this is happening. Went out to San Francisco. you know, day one, meeting Robin Williams in the inaugural ceremonies, who rode with us for a couple days. Probably one of the best famous people I've ever met.
So not just like the first hour where the cameras were there,
no.
But like for a while.
Yeah, he was an adamant cyclist. Absolutely hilarious. Probably more funny off camera than he was on camera. And loved who we were and what we were doing. And not that I or like any of us really need affirmation, but like it just absolutely affirmed like what we were doing was meaningful, was important. And that was really cool. But yeah, we met in San Francisco. Day one, dipped our rear tires in the Pacific Ocean. That was World Team Sports, by the way.
Okay.
World Team Sports was the organization that did us. Yeah, shout out. We dipped our tires in the Pacific Ocean, and 63 days later, and right around 4,000 miles, we dipped our front tires in the Atlantic. That's the first time I ever started talking about my experience, and like what we were doing, and like. Is raising awareness is basically so that people can get out there and then do things no matter what's going on. Basically to inspire people to kind of just, you know, do what you're passionate about or just get out there and have a hobby, and recover from whatever's happening. Probably one of the highest points in my recovery process. And if you ever get a chance to tour a country on a bicycle, you get to eat as much food as you want. You sleep really well.
Right.
And it was amazing. And there's amazing, bunch of other amazing individuals on that too. That I could probably talk for an hour on. Anyway. After that, I went to 2-1, back to 2-1, finally made it back to 2-1. And, I was still very injured. Like I could cycle all day long. I could lift a lot of weights, but like, as soon as I threw a ruck on, I would get about a mile down the road and I would have to drop it. And I would be like my ankles would be in severe pain. Right. Like they just were, I just couldn't move. And, usually for like several hours or like days after that, it would just be severe pain. So I had now been recovering for almost 2 years and I was like, I got to do something else. I got to go and do something. Cause I was sitting there watching all my buddies deploy, watching all my buddies work. And that was really hard. So that was my first move to AETC, where I thought it would be the greatest thing ever. And it was a really good experience. And everything that happened was exactly what needed to happen.
Right.
So I asked to come back to Texas, where I had a lot of experience. The Center for the Intrepid was right down the road. So if I needed any more care on my feet or my ankles, I could go there. And I became an instructor at the Combat Control Selection Course. And eventually ran what was known as the battle program. For all those out there that have been in the battle program or experienced it.
You're not going to apologize to those poor kids?
I'm not going to apologize. rather, I'll say you're welcome. And it was a program where we had to take all the students who are in between courses. So if you're weighing a course or in between courses and maintain their human performance, maintain their enculturation, continue to try to move them further down the field until they graduate their apprentice courses, which is usually about 18 months. Side note is when I met Connor Matthews, who came in the pipeline, and I tried to kill him for 18 months and he's unbreakable. Which gives me a lot of faith in him in the UFC. Dana, you made a really good decision on Connor.
I mean, if you've seen him fight, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have no doubts. He's an unbelievable human being. Absolutely has no, there's no chance he's ever going to quit. And whether it's in the water, on the land, we put him in a lot of chaotic scenarios, just like all the other students. And, you know, if you talk to a lot of folks, I would be particularly one of the harder instructors. And I would do things, because at the time it was very near to, when I had been injured and I was doing that and I still do it to this day. We turn it up because we don't want you to survive. We want you to perform. And if that chaos is injected into your life, like it was for me, like, I don't want you to, you know, die. I want you to survive and I want you again to perform. And be successful at whatever operation you may find yourself in.
Yeah.
It happens on a lot of different levels. So you can be driving down the road, get hit by a car, T-bone from someone that's not paying attention. You know, you can be blown up by an IED. But chaos injects itself in our lives, and so that's one of the whole things behind maintaining that human performance.
Well, I think one of the reasons we bring beret wearers back to be instructors, because it's very expensive, and technically, per like the Air Force, we don't have to teach our own pipeline. You know what I mean? Like technically you could bring in someone else and teach them with the curriculum. They can pass the tests, whatever. And then they could teach our pipeline, but bringing that reality to it, creating that resilient human being based on your experiences is so important. And that's why we invest so heavily into the training and send our guys and some of our best folks off team, you know, when we could be using them to train these young folks.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, that's what it was like. We had a great staff, everything we were doing, it went really well. One of the things that I did when I was an instructor was I got to go to a place called Athletes Performance. It's now known as Exos. It's kind of like where professional athletes, Olympians, or like the highest of the high level athletes go to, you know, do physical rehabilitation and then also increase their human performance. And they have this whole systemic approach to human performance that I'd never before heard. Prior to that, you know, in our communities, we did a lot of CrossFit, a lot of lifting and things like that, but it was never, you know, all put together quite as well as they did at Athletes Performance or Exos.
You were hitting some plateaus, right? They were trying.
Yes.
It was hard. Like you kind of pushed your personal, experience and knowledge on how to make yourself better to like the limit. And so like you needed.
Yeah. Yeah. And the things that they taught you and the things that I learned, whether I admitted it at the time or not, like I was absolutely at a hard plateau. I could not put a ruck on and move very far. And I was just dealing with all kinds of stuff. But after I got back from Exos, a couple weeks there, and it was just like no limits. And it was right around the same time I had completed my degree with Embry-Riddle, and it was awesome. So, you know, natural course of things, like I was just like, you know, I've always wanted to be a leader in this community. I have some deficiencies, like no matter what, I'm more of a liability now because I have these injuries. And so I was like, you know, not that our officers don't do anything. but like, I feel that the officers have a bigger role in, making sure the men have, or the team has, right equipment, being in the right place, the right time to do the missions. And I felt like that was my calling at that time because, you know, I had the experience. And so I made a call down to Herbert Field, Florida. I said, when's the next dose selection? And they're like, it's in 2 months.
Were they like, is this the guy that was dead for seven minutes?
Yeah. They're like, oh no, Espo, it's in 2 months. We're going to crush you. Yeah. Pack your shit. I went right back into training mode, and did start, you know, same things like before military, like I'm in the pool every day. I'm doing 2-a-days. I did some of my own self-initiated ETDs, finding like little hills or rocks and like moving for 24 hours. And had some amazing individuals jump on that bandwagon, and we trained together. So that absolutely made it a lot better. Pain shared is pain divided. It's kind of like, it just makes it so much better when you're working with somebody else. But went to stow selection, and for the longest time, I was in the military for 10 years at that time. It was nice to kind of be a student again, to be, what'd you say earlier? To be the nail isn't so bad.
Yeah.
And it's something that it felt really good. Number one, because I was seeing, as an instructor, that the stow selection was as hard as I had heard it was. I had never actually gone and worked one as a cadre, but it was insane. Like, I was like, these guys are turning it up, and I'm like, yes, let's go. Because, you know, you think you really hope, like after you leave the pipeline, you're just like, oh, I heard it's getting weaker, I heard it's getting easier. And it's kind of like that whole mentality of like, you know, when I was in, it was like this much harder. We did
so hard.
Yeah. But it was absolutely amazing. I got crushed. It was fun, and I had a great team that I was with. There's a lot of amazing individuals on that SO selection team, and some of them that got picked up I'm still friends with today. some that didn't get picked up, I'm still friends with today. They're doing amazing things.
You didn't
things.
Cut them out of your life?
Nah.
You're like,
they're good.
You non-selects.
They're good people. Oh, yeah.
Don't ever call me again. Lose my number.
Yeah. I'm better. No. There's some pretty awesome folks out there. They're doing probably better than they would if they got selected anyways. Yeah. But we went through that, came back. After I commissioned, I actually stayed back in ATC for a little bit. I was the exec for the group when we stood up the Special Warfare Training Group.
Which, as I recall, was not disappointing for you in the least bit.
Oh, it was, it's probably the most important job I think I've ever been a part of, like at the time. And then it's probably the least coolest job I've ever been a part of. But thankfully, the command team I was working with was exactly what I needed. They were great mentors to me at the time. And we had to break a lot of things to reconstruct them. And so that we did. Nothing's always perfect. We're essentially changing, several decades of how things were, and we were building a command structure at the time as well. So that was very rewarding to be a part of. But what I had been itching to do, the same thing I'd been itching to do when I came in the military, was just get after it and get back to the team. So since I was injured, I had not been back on a team. I had got back to jumping, got back to diving, got back to shooting, doing all the things. But I hadn't made it back to the teams, and I knew I could. And, it's really like my biggest goal, or one of my biggest goals in life. And so, I got an assignment to the 22 STS out in Seattle, and, family and I moved out there and, got back on team. I had to spend a little bit of time in ops, which is like the biggest insult, absolutely necessary to understand, to spend your time in ops and do that. Again, very important.
We see the battle rhythm of the squadron. I'm like, I know it probably was all. I didn't know that part, because I remember you being a little disappointed that, A, you're a talented person, you're a smart guy, you've been in AATC. So when they stood up the new command team and they sucked you into that, because, mm-hmm. They wouldn't have to explain everything to you, it wasn't the best thing. I did not know that as soon as you finally made it back to a squadron, they threw you in ops, but.
Yeah. Sometimes I think like prior enlisted operators have become officers. That's like the pens you have to pay to go back, because they're like, you're just trying to be a cool young guy all the time.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of time in ops. I actually learned a little bit about planning and training and that kind of thing. But then I finally made it back to teams and it was absolutely amazing. Again, Connor Matthews, he was on one of our teams. It was just really cool to see him there, along with a lot of the other guys that were students of mine in the pipelines. But really quickly on Connor, this is a guy that, made it through the pipeline, crushed it, got to a team, crushing on team. Like, everything he did, he was good at. And I remember talking to him in the gym one day, and he's like, I think I'm gonna separate, and I'm gonna go for becoming a professional fighter. And a lot of people take that differently. Number one, if you come in and you do this job for 4 years, 6 years, it doesn't matter. Like, if you're deciding to get out at that point, great, man. Like, you definitely sacrifice to come in and do it for that short amount of time. And if you go to decide to do something else, like, all the power to you. How can I help you?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, I dare you to try and do that, because once you get in, you see how good it is. Like, you're not going to get rich doing it, but you are going to get so much of an opportunity to complex problem solve, have autonomy, and do it with autonomy and in trust, and it be like something that you're an operator. So it's like the pinnacle of a lot of people's lives. It's, for me, it was the pinnacle of my life, probably as a staff surgeon, to go and do that. But Connor's like, nope, I'm gonna give up everything that is for sure in my life, my paycheck, my job, which I'm crushing, everything. And I'm going to pursue something that I have even less likely chance of being successful in, which is becoming a professional fighter.
Well, I just achieved an almost impossible task by making it here.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do is go chase something with even if there was a selection rate for guys that started out to become professional fighters and how many make it to the UFC, even worse odds, like way worse odds than.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah, just shout out to that dude, man.
Yeah.
But anyways, the 2-2 was awesome. It was great. I got to deploy to a couple of different places. is definitely different than the STSs of my heyday, I guess, when I was an operator, but it's just how it's always going to be. The STSs and special tactics, special operations in general is going to adapt to whatever the challenge is. And that is one of the fun things about being in this world is because you never will have two operators who are going to have the exact same experience. You'll never have an operator who is just going to be like, I'm the jump guy, or I'm the dive guy, or I'm the, you know, this guy. And that's the thing he's going to do for the rest of his career, or the thing they're going to do for the rest of their career. It's not like that. You're going to move around. You're going to shoot. You're going to move. You're going to communicate. You're going to do medical stuff. And it's going to be amazing. There's never going to be a time where there's no problems you're solved, or you have solved all the problems.
No. We will create problems if we need something to solve. Like, that's just who we are.
So,
I know you're talking about it, but like, I harp on this a little bit every time when people are like, oh, like I can't decide between like being controller, PJ, SR, or whatever. Like, what do you want to do? And I'm like if you stick around, like the amount of combat control stuff I've been able to do, you know, and the courses I've been able to go to, the amount of PJ stuff, you know, like all the medical and everything kind of blends together to create this kind of symbiotic, you know, human. Like, obviously I'm not like a JTAC or combat control expert or a PJ, but like you get a cross train in a whole bunch of different things, and the breadth of the experience that you get and the training is almost impossible to describe.
I've been accused of being a stoje like 1,000 times because I like saving people, but like I could tell you without a shadow of a doubt, and this could be just reaffirming that I am very glad I'm a combat controller, or I was a combat controller and a stow now. But man, there's not a bad job.
Yeah.
There's not a bad job. PJs, combat control, SR, TACP, these are all positions you're going to have to be a complex problem solver. And again, going back to if you want to serve 4 years or 6 years and get out, there's nothing else you could do post college or post high school where you're going to go and do this, you're going to get this level of trust and this experience, and then the world is your oyster.
Yep.
You want to go be a professional fighter. You want to go be a business leader. You want to go be the best at whatever it is you want to go be. Like, you're going to probably have a far greater chance of being successful at that thing, having this as the experience. And then if you try this, I think one of the recent podcasts you guys had, I think someone said, you try this and you're unsuccessful, you have subjected yourself to such a high level of scrutiny, you will walk away better.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to win no matter what.
Yep.
Like, and you're not a bad person if you don't make it through this stuff. Statistically speaking, you've been brave enough and you've tried something that you knew you probably were going to fail.
Yeah. After the sting wears off, like, you've done it before, just like anything else, right? Like, you, once you have experience in anything,
oh, yeah,
then it's easier to do it again. Like, you took a huge risk, you put yourself out there, and just because it didn't work out, like the next time a risk comes along or an opportunity with risk involved, you're more likely to be able to jump into that and take advantage of the opportunities presented to you for the rest of your career or life.
Yeah.
Sorry. No. I get excited.
Yeah. We'll talk more about this on the pipeline session, but really quickly, my time at 2-2 STS was amazing. After the 2-2, I was not by choice, sent back to Texas, back to ATC, to the schoolhouse. And, you know, coming back, and I'll never forget, like, leaving the, you know, go to the 2-2, and I was like, wow, never going back there again. That's weird. And then driving back to San Antonio, just like, all right. Number one, San Antonio is an awesome place. There's just so many good people and things here. But coming back, I came back after everything had been dismantled. So INDOC went away, CCSC went away, courses of initial entry, and it completely changed. And that was a hard pill to swallow for me. And so looking into it, initially, like, there were certain things that were done with the pipeline. And I was kind of like put into a position where I was going to be a flight commander for ANS and pre-dive. And over the last 3 years, I can say we've made some adjustments. We've made some changes. And it's never been a more professional, repeatable, fair and equitable course for individuals wanting to be special or, you know, AFSPEC war.
Right.
And, you know, the whole slow EV process, there's, you know, different opinions on that. I could tell you that you're 100% in control of, you know, the career that you're going to get. Almost like 80% of the people that come in get their first choice. Right. And we work with the numbers. We don't have quotas, but we essentially stick to the process, which is why it's fair and equitable and why if you show up and you perform, you're going to get what you want. However, if you don't get what you want, there's always a chance to cross train later, or you're going to find out that you didn't actually know what any of these jobs were. And the thing that you ended up with is like the best thing in the world.
Right.
You know, that goes into the whole knowledge is power type thing. Well, too much knowledge is like kind of confusing.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I came in, I had a trifold and I had a recruiter, at least that would admit he doesn't know exactly what we do, but I need to train as much as possible to be ready to go into the pipeline. You know, a suggestion for the people who are going to be coming in or want to come in, you know, pay attention to what's out there, do your research, and then turn your computer off and just go train.
Yeah.
Chop wood, carry water.
Yeah, I think
like it's, yeah, too much information is bad.
There were a lot of advantages to like crossing over to the special operations side and me having no idea really what I was getting into. So there's like this boogeyman, you know, down the hallway. Oh, yeah. And like, it was terrifying. So it's like, what do? You train as much as you can and you be as fit as you possibly can. And like, you got to be ready for every eventuality. And like, yeah, there's a certain amount of anxiety about it, but like, that was good. It was the performance anxiety that pushes you. So like, no matter how much you read on the internet or how much you listen to this podcast, just understand there's still a whole bunch of stuff that you're not aware of. And so keep training. Like there's a boogeyman down the hallway ready to get you.
Yeah, pretty much. I think, yeah, I mean, Denzel Washington, great quote, you know, dreams are just dreams. And ultimately they feel disappointment, or on the road to achieving your dreams, they feel disappointment. Our dreams are just dreams. And without goals, they feel disappointment. Basically he gets at, you know, you have to be committed, to start, but without being consistent, you'll never finish.
Yep.
So you have to be consistent with that. And I feel like, you know, going back to my story for the last time, throughout my career, I was consistent. And if you make it like a reference to like, say, a coffee cup, you know, you damage a coffee cup, it gets nicked on the edge, it gets cracked here and there. It's not broken. And as long as it's not broken, it's going to hold water. It's going to be able to do the function of the coffee cup.
Yeah.
As individuals, I think that, you know, you're going to get nicked. Like there's no chance you're not going to get nicked. There's no chance. There's nobody that makes it through the life as an operator, especially, and doesn't get nicked. But like, as long as you don't realize that, like, you're not broken, like you're still going to hold water. You're still going to be able to do the mission. You're still going to be able to get after it in whatever sense that is to you, I guess. So that's,
yeah.
It's kind of like a thing that I discovered, in a place that I spent a lot of my time, that I don't like, and that's not the gym, that's, washing dishes. As a, you know, as a 40-year-old dad trying to do my part. Yeah. So I think that, yeah, you are unbroken. That's something that I've, kind of like hinged on. I think that that's a good motto. That's a good mindset to be in. I have a new IG channel or page, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's called. I'm 40, but, yeah,
if you want to MySpace too,
I have to work on that. But yeah, it's Esposito_unbroken. And it's basically going to be a bunch of things about me, where I'm at right now, things that were in my life, and how it's just an example or a dramatic example of like, how no matter what, I'm unbroken. And it'll be, I'll have some things on there that show like other people and some of the things that they've been through and how they're unbroken.
Yeah. No. So yeah, go check it out. Esposito_unbroken. And honestly, as we wrap up here, dude, like I remember first meeting you and you telling me your story. So I know you don't like to do it because the first time I heard your story was like, IED. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now I'm back. And like, blah, blah, blah. Like, there was very little. And I know like, it's not the most fun thing to do is to talk about yourself, but really appreciate you coming on here and sharing your story as in depth as you have. And, we're going to have you back to talk about pipeline stuff. I know you really like it when I go out there. I'm like, the Instagrams and talk about how y'all should be better. It's fun. And so we can argue about that later. But if you have anything else for everybody out there, any advice or whatever, we always ask for advice at the end. So it feels weird to not ask for advice at the end, even though you just got an hour of goodness, y'all. So stop being selfish.
Advice for anyone out there? Yeah, stay thirsty and tune in. We are going to go over the pipeline. We're gonna address some of the things in the how to fix the pipeline. But this is a pretty good channel to pay attention to, especially if you're going to be coming in. The information you get on here is going to be inconsistent. It's going to be all over the map, but it's going to be, you know, from the perspectives of the people that come on. And we're staying true to it. It's not like you're not going to get any misinformation on here. So
yeah. We're only pushing my personal agenda. It's not the other stuff.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, everybody out there, like, subscribe, and Mark, thanks for coming on. Thanks, I call you Mark.
Is that okay?
That's cool. Thanks, brother. There you go.